Welcome to X Squared Radio.
The spice extends life.
I'm your host, Brooks Agnew.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Whether you are driving across the frosty desert tonight or at your computer working on your favorite project, you are about to discover more about where we came from, why we are here, and where we may be going than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Recline your chair, look out the window, as we are about to launch another evening on X Squared Radio. Welcome, my friends. Welcome. We're coming to you from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Sorry for the late start. Technical problems. We overcame them all. The solar wind is about 360 kilometers per second, and the proton count really is the highest I've seen it in years at 8.0 protons per cubic centimeter. Not that you're going to be out sunbathing or anything today. Just thought you should know. Also, Russia's malfunctioning Mars probe, Phobos Grunt, will re-enter the atmosphere today, creating a brilliant fireball over a still unknown part of the Earth, so get your shopping carts ready. Best estimates of the re-entry time range from about now to about noon tomorrow. There are also six active sunspot clusters on the sun. These sunspots have the potential for strong eruptions. Sunspot 1401 produced a M1 class flare on January 14th, yesterday. And 2 days earlier, while it was still on the far side of the sun, sunspot 1402 produced a partially eclipsed flare of uncertain magnitude that created waves of ionization in the atmosphere over Europe. The two new ones are crackling with C-class solar flares. A pair of active sunspots is emerging over the sun's northeastern limb. These are high-latitude sunspots, very active. I got to tell you, Earth explorers, this is like a six-shooter aimed at Earth and loaded with high-energy protons that could fry electrical transmission equipment. So be alert and have your 72-hour kits ready. Don't let your guard down now. We have about 2 years before we are out of this danger zone. So you listen to this program, you got about 72-hour warning. So as the Phobos Grunt is sinking back into Earth's atmosphere, take into account the current space weather forecast and the area to mass ratio of the spacecraft. Hang on a second while I put this on my calculator. Yes, re-entry within a few hours of the end of tonight's program. Now, the window of uncertainty is still too large to pinpoint exactly where the fireball will occur. But be careful out there. This thing is heavy at several tons, and it's full of hydrazine and catalyst retros. You remember it was supposed to go to Mars and go around the moon Phobos, and it never left orbit. Something went wrong with it. Not really sure what that is. Well, a couple of items. I want to let you know the phone lines are open, 888-429-5471, and anywhere else on planet or off planet. If you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-6472. You can also join by conference call, and I encourage you to do that if you're going to step out of the house. It won't be too much longer. A few months, we're going to have an app, an iPhone and Droid app, so you can listen to BBS radio anytime you want to. That's coming. Other neat things coming with the number one webcast radio network on the web. As you're making your plans this year, and it's ticking away, folks, we're already halfway through January. As the year is ticking away, I want you to make plans to be with me at Chichen Itza from December 13th to December 22nd. Yeah, that's right. December 21st, 2012, you can be with me at Chichen Itza, hosted by Power Places. Greg Braden and others are going to be there. And playing in, at the same venue is going to be Sting and Carlos Santana. So this is going to be one heck of a show, and you're going to learn something. You might change. So you'll be able to tell your kids and your grandkids when they ask you, where were you at December 21st, 2012? And you'll say, I was at Ground Zero with Brooks Agnew and his group. Maya 2012, that's what I'm talking about. The orange banner at xsquaredradio.com. Click on it. Get your deposit in now. There are going to be thousands of people there. This place is going to be rocking. And you never know who might return. You just never know. Maya 2012, join me there. Now, tonight's program. Are you ready? Just loosen your seatbelt a little bit. I know you're already leaning back, looking out the window with your favorite beverage, but hang on. Envision a world in the not-too-distant future in which immortality has been achieved in the form of virtual databases containing all the information, biological and psychological, of each individual human being. Tonight, we have the author of Who is Sponsoring Transhumanism, Nigel Kerner, and his associate, John Biggerstaff, coming on the program to bring the future, the human condition, for your consideration in about 5 minutes. So do not turn away. Do not fear. You are safe with us here at X Squared Radio. The doomsday clock is moving closer to midnight. Oh, you've heard about it. You've heard about it. It's out there. These guys watch it. By at least one measure, the world got just that much closer to apocalypse. The doomsday clock, a figurative timepiece used as a barometer of humankind's fate, was moved 1 minute closer to midnight on Tuesday of this week, the first time it has been nudged forward since 2007. It is now 11:55, 5 minutes before the appointed hour. The resetting of the clock has become something of a gimmick in recent years, carried out by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, a group established to raise awareness about the perils of nuclear weaponry and aimed at warning the public about various catastrophic dangers. But the process involved in deciding the time is a deeply serious one. Overseen by a venerable board of scientists, Nobel laureates, and others, and concluded with a symposium in Washington, the setting of the clock is no longer based only on the proliferation of nuclear arms, but also on threats such as climate change and biological weaponry. In moving the clock ahead on Tuesday, the BAS, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, cited the failure of world leaders to achieve significant progress on the reduction of nuclear weapons and in developing a comprehensive response to climate change. I told you, climate change is upon us. Just 2 years ago, following global talks on climate change in Copenhagen and international pledges to reduce nuclear stockpiles, the BAS moved the clock backward by 1 minute. Well, Robert Sokolow, a professor at Princeton University and a member of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, during an event announcing a reset of the doomsday clock, faced with clear and present dangers of nuclear proliferation and climate change and the need to find sustainable and safe sources of energy, world leads are failing to change business as usual. That's why the clock was moved forward. So are we looking at solutions? Are we getting ready to choose leaders who can walk us, lead us, point us in the general direction? Don't be fooled, my friends. You are about to be deluged, washed over, warmed and massaged by billions of dollars worth of propaganda in the next 10 months. Be aware, be awake, and remember, you're not electing a manager. You're electing a leader. You know the difference, don't you? A manager does things right. A leader does the right thing. Let's get our guests on, Nigel Kerner and John Biggerstaff. Welcome to the program, my friends.
Yeah. Hi there, Brooks. This is Nigel Cutter talking to you from Oxford in England.
And hi from John Biggerstaff in Tennessee.
Wow. It doesn't get any better than this, guys. This is free press at its best, where we can come together from points all over the world at one time and enlighten the world with one brilliant idea.
You expect too much of us, but we'll do our best.
Let's talk about transhumanism. You know, I've seen it out there over the years. It's kind of an intellectual and cultural movement kind of thing where a bunch of people think that we're going to, and I guess we slowly are, you know, with laser surgery and pacemakers for our hearts and stents for our arteries and battery-powered this and that to augment the human body. We're getting there, aren't we? So tell us what transhumanism is.
Well, I mean, it's kind of scope to go nowhere, really. Basically, is the way in my take on this, Brooks, and that is that, you know, we'll stand up here with all our natural glory, coming down in a wonderful. I don't know if you're hearing me, but in a cascade of. A species, natural species from the birth of the universe, so to speak, and we go back in this wonderful line that says that we have ancestry that goes back into that very moment that the universe burst in, bringing with it consciousness, and all that seems to deploy as a natural cascade of the creation, existential creation of a species, and then as we come towards a particular stage of this incredible line down at this particular moment, we go from this naturalness, it seems to me, into a synthetic deployment, which the beginning of which is the beginning for me of the end of reason and the starting of unreason, so to speak. So I want to make a very simple, sounds a bit obscure that way, the way I kind of put it, but a very simple distinction. The name of the game is between what is natural and what is synthetic. And I'd like to kind of, you know, identify this before we go into what transhumanism might mean in the particular and so on. And for me, a synthetic being is anything, and that is created out of the mass and the materiality, so to speak, of the universe of parts. We have a universe of parts that is forever deploying into parts run by the second law of thermodynamics. And these parts are getting ever more complicated with time. So here in this universe of parts, synthetic being is something that's created out of the mass and materiality of this by a natural life form that I suppose itself comes through the incidental process of the formation of the universe itself.
The natural one we would call evolution. The synthetic one we would call gene splicing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not so sure that evolution is the right word, you know, Brooks. I think devolution is a much better word. If you buy into what all scientists now accept as the fundamental law that governs every point and posture of our universe all the way through, we've got this thing called the second law of thermodynamics. We cannot fight this monstrosity, because what it is saying,
you can,
is in effect, and the universe is finite.
You can fight it with consciousness, though. I mean, dynamics has to do.
I was going to go on to that, but what I'm saying is, you cannot fight that incidentality itself,
except
an interception of consciousness. That's quite right.
The sand guys fall apart unless you keep patching it up.
Yeah, as we stand, really, what I'm trying to say is, I'm sorry to talk over you, I do apologize, but trying to follow the point, as I say, that once, of course, this thing begins, we then, with the second law of thermodynamics, we unravel into greater states of randomness and chaos with time. Now, that is an amazing thing, which means, of course, that it gives a posting to everything as finite. There is going to be an end to it all sometime. There is a beginning and there will be an end. Now, this incredible situation actually talks about devolution, not evolution. Evolution might be a way you change. It's commonly taken to be a change for the better. What I'm trying to say is that the natural cascade is downwards. It's breaking up. Even atoms will be breaking up. Even atom particles will be breaking up. And so in the end, there'll be, they think, what the phenomenon called the heat death of the universe. Some say the coldness of the universe, where everything is just a huge field of tension of absolute force, so to speak, with absolutely nothing of any structure, form, whatever, within the universe itself. Now, if that is the natural fate of incidental acquisition, so to speak, if I can put it that way, we have to see where into this we come in with syntheticness. How are things actually happening that are synthetic? It means it has to come out of that which is natural, creating synthetic forms. And they are a creation that has been made up through a kind of derivational assembly, and of itself has no living and conscious format. Now, this is the big deal here. A format that, you know, is kind of accrued out of that first singularity that gave rise to the Big Bang, and that's the universe with awareness and will as the main components built in.
Well, let's talk that just for a minute. Let's lay a foundation. Yeah. Because, you know, when we talk about this great I am moment, when consciousness, some single consciousness in a void became self-aware and decided to burst forth as a multitude of consciousnesses in this universe, there was that desire to exist, to think, to feel, to interact with one another. Now, we could go all back into the big snooze and go back into the big singularity, but Nigel, that doesn't sound like heaven to me. Heaven to me sounds like something with a challenge, something with a frontier out there. That's what we're driven to do from our very instincts, which is the opposite of entropy, is it not?
Yeah, well, I don't think this actually happens in any sense with a format to happen, so to speak. I think it's an incidental thing that if there's a yin, there's a yang. If there's an altogether state where everything is in perfect harmony and timeless and of all and all knowledge contained within this singularity that is eternal and goes on forever without end, there also has to be the possibility, the incidental possibility of its opposite. If there's a yin, there's a yang. If there's a plus, there's a minus. The whole system of continuity has to proceed on a duality. It cannot be within a singularity because nothing within a singularity will know anything other than singularity-ness.
Yeah, so you're exactly right. There's no perspective. It's sort of like going to a concert and having them only play the harmony parts. You wouldn't even recognize the song because the rest of the pieces are missing.
You bet. And that's what I'm trying to say. So here we have a action waiting to happen. The word is incidentally, if you see what I'm trying to say, simply because it's there, so to speak, Brooks. And that is the interesting proposition we're looking at when we come into this question of transhumanism, which we look at now on our planet at this stage of time as things progress and so on. So one looks at, I was looking at this from no point of view of philosophy at all. I was dragged into it as an absolute skeptic by my son's question, Dad, are UFOs real? I think I mentioned this in my last interview with you. And really, it's drawn me into a very, very heavy, almost pedantic, almost obscure situation of trying my best to figure out now through this whole portrayal of that of the incidental nature of things, where on earth are we naturally going? And where on earth can creation, that's some decision-making invective from within that incidentality, how can this particular thing play a part and where do we go with this situation? So if we have this cascade that comes from a beginning and it progresses within the state of the second law of thermodynamics, leading it, so to speak, into a backwards posture, strangely enough, to return from whence it came, if you see what I'm trying to say, in this circle, this continuity. And duality actually runs the whole thing. Incidental duality runs the whole thing. We then have to look at this stage in between, you know, and what happens to anything there, so to speak, as we look at that, you know. And so when I see this from the point of view of a philosopher's eye, one has all kinds of conclusions one can draw and metaphors and stuff that we can light it up with. And then you've got this other thing which says these are the rigid fixtures that propose the system itself. Now, where can we go and how can we go past all of these things?
Well, yeah, so, and then deciding or realizing what the rigid fixtures are, because, you know, from my standpoint, entropy has really taken its course in Washington. So they really can't be the fixtures we're talking about.
Well, I've got to tell you something. If I just may interrupt you, I think that happened when we had this press club announcing the most amazing evidence for the existence of these kinds of things coming into our planet, UFOs, call it what you like, and there was absolutely no comment around the world at all. How on earth did they wipe all this out, Brooks?
That was in May of 2001, and now we are in January of 2012, 11 years later since that press club announcement, which was put on by the venerable Stephen Greer and his associates.
No. This is what I'm talking about, the most more recent one that happened last year, in fact. The Washington Press Club one, you know. Where all the chaps gathered together and hailed UFOs as being real, including some of our astronauts and so forth, and asked the world, now come on, we're not fools, we're trained observers, we know these things are here, why is the government hiding it, what on earth is going on? And that's just last year, and that has not been actually in any kind of mainstream invective at all, and that is the most fascinating thing of all, Brooks. Who is holding all this back? How is it being held back? Why is it being held back? And that's why you and I are having this conversation now, I think, is because somewhere along the line, whatever our postures are as dads or whatever, we are looking at this, just reasoning things out, as all human beings will try to do. Where on earth is this taking us, and what is it taking us to? And you were talking about the atomic clocks in such an erudite way earlier. Well, is this inevitable, or is there some kind of way that we can penetrate this particular problem we've got and intervene with the atomic clock, or is it just going to be as inevitable as the action of the second law of thermodynamics?
Well, if there is an instrument upon the planet whereby we can intervene, it would probably be the constitution of this country. Lord knows, lots of countries have tried from the bottom up to make a change in the direction their government is heading. And they've done a good job at breaking out the windows and, you know, disrupting the flow of commerce in their countries. And they've produced a wonderful hotbed, a garden plot for those small but well-organized and powerful groups who would move in and take over everything. So they've basically handed it from one despot to another. But in this country, we have a process by which, hopefully, if too many dead people don't vote, we have an effect by our single votes, and we can change not only the face of our country, but hopefully the face of the world. So we do have a process, but it's very difficult to awaken people to their individual power in that process.
Let me, at this stage, you pay a compliment to America. Now, if there is any situation politically in the world we call a country, shall we say, that can do anything and can actually claim to be free, I believe, and I'm saying this now as someone who's not American, I believe that the Americans are the freest people in the world. Now, if the freest people in the world can have generals and astronauts who have seen and reported on the presence of this phenomenon we call the UFO, whatever, have to take out a particular announcement procedure called the Washington Press Club just last year, if this incredible facility to be free, and anyone who goes to America notices this, especially from a country, well, us Brits, for instance, we love to say that we are free, but we're really not free. We make any kind of statement that's a little bit passe or a little bit out of kilter, so to speak, and we'll stick a D notice on it, and nobody in the country will ever see that. It's called a D notice, and no one ever sees that except, ironically, at the Library of Congress, where that same D notice is usually available for Americans to read. And that's the kind of irony that we're getting to here. So I'm proclaiming America here as, in a sense, something that we all should look to in terms of countries and so on, a measure of freedom that has such a scale. And yet, where is all this going? There seems to be a sump. I think there is a big umbrella organization. 96% of the world's media is controlled by it for some political shenanigans or some political reason. Perhaps not in-house America, but by controlling America in that kind of fashion, this kind of information is not actually let out, so to speak. And that's the worrying thing, both about transhumanism and every other thing that might happen in the future to do with the atomic clock and its ticking towards midnight, if you see what I'm trying to say. So yeah. It's a very, very serious thing we've got here. We've got America the Free, this country that might give the whole world hope in terms of an example of actually saying things as they are, giving the citizen the right to see where the citizen needs to go and, by and large, with some reasonable controls, to make sure that it's available for change and so forth. You talk about leadership and you talk about, you know, natural progressions and so forth. Well, you know, we can't appoint leaders that will be great messiahs. They just, I think, naturally happen out of the political inventive of peopleness, so to speak. This Gandhi came from South Africa. He didn't come from India in the sense he happened out of the Indian invective. He happened out of the South African invective and then went on to become a great teacher in his own philosophical backdrop, so to speak, in India. And so we had a great teacher there. We had the wonderful Abraham Lincoln, and we had several other people from America coming through and so forth. These things just happen, it seems, incidentally. And of course, I really have got the most incredible insight now into something that they've just proved just a few weeks ago with this piece of cloth that covered a dead body, in a Judean tomb 2,000 years ago, and scientists to the present day, Brooks, with all the incredible technological capacities we have, cannot duplicate what happened to make the mark of a man with full, accurate forensic expressions on a piece of cloth that showed that something happened to scorch that piece of cloth at 34,000 billion watts. In a Judean tomb. I'm talking about the Shroud of Turin that a group of scientists have got together, investigated to see if it was a forgery, and have come to the conclusion it cannot be a forgery because this remarkable thing has happened there. Now, if that is in any way tied to our human capacities, our natural human capacities, then what we're talking about tonight is a very, very interesting discussion, and that includes what the take that we might have on transhumanism.
Well, I believe that the human soul is just such a trans-dimensional power plant. And, you know, the realization that a man can resurrect, can somehow re-energize the body and emanate and become such a light being to put out that much power, I think is completely possible. It is possible if you believe the words of Jesus, because he said each one of us can do this. We can do this. He tried to show us how. Now, that's been obscured over the years by various power mongers who want to make sure that you can't do it on your own. You have to go through the church. And by the way, don't forget to pass by the little wooden box at the end of the hall and put some money in on your way out and on your way in. But we have this common origin inside of us that I think is the fascination of the universe. If it was not, why would we be such a theater for all of these UFOs to come here and observe us like lab rats?
I don't think it's observation. I think it's a very, very dangerous situation that might naturally happen to any development on any planet. I'm talking natural development on any planet from a natural sense of being, so to speak. I'm talking about living beings on a particular planet that belong there. And that's the thing that I really thump about in my books and so on, is because I'm absolutely convinced over 30-odd years of research, painstaking research, I might add, into this, that there is something extremely crazy that can happen if you just simply follow, strangely enough, the lines of logic. Now, previously, you were alluding to this business about Jesus and the shroud in your slightly cynical but absolutely accurate axiom when you said, "Praise the Lord and pass me the money." Now, you know that something as beautiful as this man, who, if he was a liar, would have gone away from the streets of Jerusalem rather than go in and face the mangling and death that he prophesied he would face if he went in, before he actually went in, any con man would run the other way, Brooks, at the gates of Jerusalem, if he saw that he was going to face this kind of situation, this kind of death, so to speak. And yet this man walked in there and took it on the chin, so to speak. And we have this incredible example of the fortitude and faith and wonder of humanity that he was trying to display, and as you say, to show us all, every single one of us, our potential. He said, I mean, after all, in the New Testament, there's clear reference to what something he said there that says, "Don't ye know ye are gods?" So what has lost us? This incredible propensity to being what we would commonly describe as gods, so to speak, by the common invective. Something is reducing us. Something is curtailing us. And if we do not actually see what it is, our planets may just be schematics of blinking transistors and diodes out there with nothing that is movable, that is livable, just a empty scale of buzzers and clicks and grunts, so to speak. And I think that what happens is that if natural life forms develop synthetic life forms and give them artificial intelligence, and you do not, through that programming process, allow the idea that these synthetic life forms, in gaining more and more intelligence on a quantum scale, may one day seek to pull the plug on the creators. If we do not see how this can be prevented, how this should be prevented, you will set out there an entire army of these things moving out into planet after planet, coming across places like ours, and seeking to use the natural life forms for their dominion, not ours, for their reasons and not ours. And that is the thing that I really want to actually take through with some kind of cogent description later on in the program, if I may, together with Dr. John Biggerstaff.
I can see the general direction and the thought process that machines, let's just call them machines, reach a point of artificial intelligence or intelligence that they become desirous to propagate their own kind and thereby expand out into the universe and literally take over biological systems and improve their own systems with that biology. But in essence, it is an eternal machine. It is an omega point where we reach this level of complexity that we overcome the second law of thermodynamics, the thing that's constantly trying to disorganize the universe. The visible universe has to push itself to be more organized and not fall apart into a cold, homogeneous dust.
The point about this, though, is when you cannot actually instruct a machine to understand the natural invective of natural being. You cannot describe a feeling. You cannot actually, in a computer program, explain an emotion. You cannot talk about conscience. You cannot talk about conscience because conscience is the entire scale of all things together at one point. And that, the fact that we have conscience, is in fact the incredible affirmation that we come from that one point all the way back where everything was together. Conscience is the summary against which we set any paradigm for comparison, if you see what I mean. And yet it's built in to all of us naturally. So how do you instruct a machine to have all of that? You cannot do that.
The machine doesn't have to have that to make those that are conscious stop breathing. I mean, they could still take over. They could still, wipe us out, conscious or not. We're going to be disembodied.
My point, though, Brooks, is when you get a machine that can do that, can actually go out there and collect its artificial intelligence in a compound sense, add-on, so to speak, the point about it is it will not be able to differentiate between what we as natural being can see and itself, because it won't even have a standpoint naturally of I am. It won't know what self is. But we can make these machines to go out there and examine asteroids or whatever. And it's all to do with the inability of instruction within the program of its creators that sets the cat amongst the pigeons.
Okay, I understand what you're saying now. It's a little bit like, it's a little bit like Democrats. They just hate everything except themselves. And they try to tear every system down except their own. It doesn't matter what's good for the country or good for their community or good for the world. They just want power. And so it is not enough to win. All others must lose.
Well, I mean, I try to keep out of politics, both family and structural out there.
Was I getting political? I'm so sorry. So sorry there. I didn't mean to.
I'm sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. I really don't understand the kind of, party politics we get in Britain, never mind in America. And I find that the worst possible thing one can do short of creating a robot is to get interested in politics and politicians. I'm allergic to them.
That's good. Well, so let's, as we're bringing this to transhumanism, I guess my question is, are there humans or living beings on this planet that are involved in this process of de-evolutionizing the human condition to propagate this machine type of existence?
Yeah, well, it depends on the take you have of what we call this thing that we describe as a soul. Now, please, I'm not going to some huge, obscure description of some religious mechanism or whatever. I simply think a soul is an information field. And I tried to give you a little description that I was searching around writing my third book in the series to try to explain to some children around me what I might mean by a soul, because one of the little ones, my grandchild, came up to me and said, "Daddy, what do you mean by this particular title, a soul?" So I thought to myself, how on earth do you describe to a child what a soul might be? And then it suddenly struck me because I saw that he was holding in his hand a mobile phone. Now, instantly the idea came to me that if you look at a mobile phone, what you're doing when you send a message, Brooks, is quite simply make an original schematic in electronics on that phone, which is called your message. So at that point, at that time, you make this particular thing on the phone. You can see the message there in letters and whatever. And then you press that button. And when you press that button, this format of electronics, however it might be contrived, you can't see it, flies across from where you are to whoever you're sending the message to. And this message then gets there, maybe 1,000 miles away, in some kind of expression. Shall we say, that's contrived of force arranging atoms in a particular, a very particular format. So that's a unique format for a second that you send over to this other person you're talking to. Not only there, but it goes out into space at 186,000 miles per second, and is going and will go on forever as information. You cannot destroy information in as much as you call information the extrapolation of meaning in some kind of way or mechanism that allows for it to be discerned as that meaning, so to speak. So this particular thing in that mobile phone, to me, gave me an idea that perhaps in some way our bioelectronics as a natural body form, shall we say, of any species, we talk about a natural body form of a species, we have a heart, we have hemoglobin, iron rushing round in a circuit around our bodies, pumped by the heart. What are we making? We are making a coil. We're making an electromagnetic field. And maybe life is a way of actually preserving information at any point of the universe. We might call this a natural life form, if you like, and that we're bringing this through in a cascade, mom, dad, great-granddad, great, and going on, so all the way back. And it's one unique line of information that ends in Brooks Agnew or Nigel Kerner or whoever. And to me, a soul may well be that unique information written as it might be written on your mobile phone, except that you have the mother and father of a fantastic machine called a human body or a natural living body somewhere in the universe to make it. So I think all natural life forms in the universe are in fact extensions from that original moment. But the real problem comes when we try to create something artificial to actually ape that, to actually duplicate that. When you do that, I think it's an impossible question. And in trying to do that, we may in fact take out that incredible original point, life form itself. And so that's why I think transhumanism and Ray Kurzweil and his mob that are trying to sell this thing big to the world are in fact doing the most terrifying possible thing of all, trying to take us out of existence, because rather like the message you send on your mobile phone, you can hack into it. You can put another message onto it. Now, supposing our soul mobile phone type field, you know, if you like, information field we call a soul, can be hacked into by a, shall we say, incredibly clever mechanical intelligence, like a roboid or whatever coming from some other alien planet, far more developed than ours, supposing they try using their information field to hack into ours. We are neither ourselves anymore, or are we them? And perhaps in doing that, they discover, because they don't know the propensity of conscience and caring and love and feeling that natural being has, they are neither themselves or us, and there could be these fields of information going nowhere. And that in that way, it may well be that we will lose our incredible propensity to living forever, if you like, because of mobile, because this message is, you know, information is cannot be created, cannot be destroyed, rather. It can even survive, they tell us, on the event horizon of a black hole. Well, it's a really scary thought that if some kind of, you know, roboidic entity arrives on a planet and can seek to download its own features onto us, because, say, for instance, they want to be born naturally, as we can be born, they might well have to be replenished, if you like, with the second law of thermodynamics and seek DNA to do that, new DNA and new DNA supplies and so forth. Maybe they're there for this. But what about us? We'll be gone forever. Each of us, this incredible thing we call a soul, this eternal scale object, which I'm trying to describe here, may have gone forever. And that, to me, is the most chilling scenario of all, Brooks.
Yeah, I agree with that. The download of our mental capacities, of all of the possibilities of our thoughts, of our emotions, of our interpersonal relations, could possibly record it. Some people call them the Akashic Records, but it's getting to a point now, especially with the Human Genome Project, we have a machine that's about the size of a desktop printer now that can take a sample of your DNA and map you down to 10 billion DNA pairs to tell if you have a propensity for, you know, diabetes or obesity or bipolarism or whatever. And since that biological program exists, after all, folks, it's just, you know, atoms put together. It's just carbon and calcium and various atoms put together into a program that makes up the human body. You know, we're all made out of the same stuff. We are what we eat. However, that's just the part you see in the mirror. The part that animates the part that you see in the mirror is quite something different. Nigel is Nigel, and Brooks is Brooks, and John is John. And you all listeners out there are your own individual animated, flying, leaping, imagining being. However, if we look at the broad population of all the people on the earth, what we see is that the vast majority of people are asleep. They're being run by some program. They get up in the morning, they go to work, they do their thing, exactly the same thing every day. They come home, they eat a very narrow range of groceries, and they go to bed. And they do the same thing until they die. However,
yeah, but some you of know, us- John, there's one thing that we can do as being an original being, we can do, and that is say no if we wanted to. And no robot can do that. A robot's always led by its program. Yes, and that's right. The definition of a robot.
Right. We can say, I quit. I'm going to change jobs. I'm going to change spouses. I'm going to change my hairstyle. I have a choice. I have desire. But we have to be awake to make those moves.
And indeed. But, you know, what this is really showing is that there is something behind that genetic code that you've just called a program, which is capable of altering what that program is. And this is where that consciousness is. You know, the genome project really predicted that we were a machine and that the genes would control everything. And now we've got some real problems because we have things like identical twins, for instance, which have got totally different behavior patterns. Some say, you know, one twin may be autistic where the other is perfectly normal. And we have these phenomenal differences, even though the individuals have the same genetic code. And therefore, this wonderful prediction that they made and are still trying to propagate erroneously, in my belief. You know, now we've got things like epigenetics, but epigenetics, what controls that? And what we're trying to really do is to actually put in and find out where this interface between this continuum of consciousness and this sort of ball and stick atomic frame is really put. Sorry to interject there, but I had to make that
that's
point.
That's good. No, Dr. Bickerstaff, that's one of the most poignant thoughts of the subject that we're covering, is that consciousness is involved in the environment of the unfolding and refolding of these proteins to repair and grow human bodies. And those identical twins over time, even their genetics moves away from one another. They no longer are so identical by the time they're 40.
Because which genes are switched on and switched off. It's not the actual genes. It's to do with the switching of them. And in fact, you know, more recently we found that this switching can actually be controlled by electric fields. And, you know, there have been some recent papers on our emotional status itself can actually alter our DNA and show this.
Right. And one of the things, you know, if I may just say, this business about transhumanism and so forth, you know, they had this recent innovation announced they call the Soul Catcher, which is some kind of implant, which, of all places, British Telecom, which is a kind of commercial company that sells telephones or whatever, is trying to develop. And the whole idea is it duplicates absolutely everything we are, it seems, or at least so they claim. And this particular thing may be inserted into all of us. Under the premise of actually getting, say, medical aid, if you don't, for instance, in some future hospital, it may be constructed in such a way as to get all the information from something implanted in the patient and then go on that and treat the patient based upon the interface patient to the machine in the hospital. Now, if this is done to all of us, Well, what's to control all those controls that go between patient and the treating interface, so to speak, that can easily be taken over, it seems to me, by whatever ruling mechanism that commands that program, if you see what I'm trying to say. And who do we think we are, then? What do we think we are? Do we know we are anything at that point, if you see what I'm trying to say, Brooks? And this is a chilling factor, because I think, you know, that many millions will buy into it, just as we bought into mobile phones and any new electronic innovation. And yet now we're getting to the point where the essence of our naturalness itself is being chased. And that, I think, with all these wonderful balms of Gilead and whatever being given to us as the, you know, this'll do this, this'll do that, and this, and there'll be billions of people who aren't really, you know, compos mentis with all of this, buying into it. And, of course, there has to be some place or somewhere where we look at this and say, oh, no, we just don't go there, you know?
Well, that's the difference between those people that would take the blue pill and go back into the matrix, not care about anything, be controlled by someone else who knows best for us, and those of us that would take the red pill and say, no, I want to live outside the matrix and make up my own mind as vacant as it might be.
Because you see, the blue pill will say to you, you have no more control. You're controlled. And the red pill will say, you have that control. It may be less in its propensity technologically than if you'd taken the blue pill, so to speak. But the problem of all matrixes that are unnaturally contrived is that the control is always outside you. And you is the most important and wonderful thing of all. This you that has come billions upon billions of years through a natural ancestry, to end in you. I see a human being quite simply as a track back to whatever was the original singularity that came before the Big Bang, whatever that might be. That point at which all knowledge is together in a totally wondrous, harmonic, timeless, and forever there, so that in instantness you can experience all things if you so want to do. And if you want to be bored, you can be bored. If you don't want to be bored, it's all made in a single fraction of a nanosecond, shall we say, as a kind of, you know, description I don't really know where. But the idea that some great being came 2,000 years ago and tried to warn us 2,000 years hence, that's a really fascinating topic. And, of course, Dr. Bickerstaff is an expert on how the conversion into biochemical structures through electronic structures and phases and so on goes. If you talk to him about this interface point, you become aware of an incredible array of danger that lies in wait for our species. And I talk about the atomic clock, Brooks. I tell you what, I'd rather have the fact that we are all gone into another frame of existence we might call death, because I believe we can always hold on to this incredible special thing about ourselves with our own control, rather than have some download come on us that might give us a central go-nowhere aegis that might keep us forever in limbo, so to speak, or each individual in limbo, so to speak, forever. And I think that's what the great teachers actually came to warn us about. Not, they weren't religious in the sense that we make them religious. They were, in fact, super scientists.
It very well could be. I could see. I don't see in the scriptures or in the historical records where they're saying, you know, beware of Twitter and Facebook. But I do see a lot of people walking around, heck, driving around with their heads down in their little electronic device, having their electronic relationship with their electronic friends, and they're not in the real world anymore. And it's really, this is only what the last 4 or 5 years this has happened. In the next 4 or 5 years, we're going to become even more biologically interfaced with electronic pieces of equipment that are going to learn about us and express ourselves or express us to others.
Well, I remember films like Light of the Silvery Moon and Moonlight Bay, and to me, that's the place I want to be.
I like riding my motorcycle. No electronic device is going to do that for me. I enjoy it.
The problem is that, you know, we are, as you quite rightly said, we're becoming more and more dependent on these devices. You know, and I work at a university, and there are huge thrusts in the universities and in the national laboratories, both to develop artificial intelligence, which is sort of like an overseeing brain, but also really to develop the interface technology for electronics and nerve cells, for instance. Partly, you know, on the auspices of really, you know, creating better medical devices, et cetera, so that the blind can see and the you know, the lame can walk, et cetera. But the problem is that once you start getting Google, the NFL, or, you know, or Mitt Romney or whatever, if you like Mitt Romney in your head, you've got a really big problem here, because you're going to start to confuse, you know, people are already generating worlds by putting goggles on, worlds which are just not real. The problem is that your consciousness starts to sort of dissociate, and therefore you really don't know what sort of control is going on. And so on the aegis of you know, selling things to you so that you can really have chips in your brain, and it's by no means far away. It's really close, actually being able to do this sort of thing. And in some things like blindness, they've actually achieved some sort of interface with the brain. Your problem is, as Nigel said, you know, your consciousness, you're effectively giving your will to effectively a hive mentality. And it's not too far from there for people, you know, because, you know, especially in America, which is, you know, capitalism, you know, we want to make a profit from what we do. This is how we live and express freedom in America, you know. But your problem is that it's not very far from doing that, putting these things in your head. And then suddenly a corporation can say, well, we own that electronics, so we're going to tell you what to do. And therefore, then you won't really know what it is. And I find that quite scary.
I do, too.
You know, and I think that it's getting more and more sort of dangerous from the point of view. I think people have forgotten this consciousness. And I think that's actually, I don't know whether it's really deliberate, but it's really happened in biological science. You know, you're a physicist, and I'm a biologist, and Nigel's already sort of pointed out that we've really got a bit of a dilemma with the difference between sort of entropy related to biology and entropy related to cosmology and the universe, you know. And really, we've got a big problem between these subject areas and the way we've specialized for so long. And biology has really taken somebody like Darwin's ideas of adaptation to environment.
Nope, I think we lost John again.
Or smaller, you know, seeds, etc. But the problem is that what's happened is that biology has gone on then to form a thing called neo-Darwinism, which, on the discovery of DNA, then applied to these Darwinistic mechanisms, have said that effectively we come from a puddle where a few molecules got together. Everything then sort of got more and more complex, and then, as if by magic, we spontaneously generated, you know, consciousness. And we're sort of going on from there. Now the point is here that really biology, and you'll find it in every biological textbook, has really put us down as an agglomeration of randomized just molecules being put together. I think that there are plenty of cases now really to show that cannot be true. But what's happened, though, is that we've now, from many different angles, really convinced very subtly and over a very long time, convinced people that they are machines, that there is nothing further on. You know, even though your very subject, physics, are the people that really came up with the idea of delocalization of electrons, etc., and you need to observe it to collapse the wave function. You know, I think you're proving consciousness as physicists.
Yeah, I think we are too. You know, I recall the great words of Sir Roger Penrose saying that consciousness is the result of quantum gravity.
Yeah, and he and Hameroff have worked on, you know, the mechanism of microtubules in the transmission of that effect. And I find that quite fascinating. I've been studying that.
Yeah, well, I wrote in my most recent book that quantum gravity is the result of consciousness. So I just want them to toy with that thought for a while.
I think that's a very good thought.
I need to... I need to take a quick break. I got to run an advertisement for one of my sponsors. It'll take me about 4 minutes. So if we could take a quick break, I'll be back in about 4 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. My good friend Hans Mittendorf has written some music and drawn some artworks, which are really, I think, fantastic. If you like soundscape stuff, I'm going to play a piece right now from him called Cosmic Wavescape. It's about 4 minutes long. Sit back, relax. Close your eyes and listen. This is Hans Mittendorf. The link is at xsquaredradio.com. Go to the affiliates. You'll see a red new age piece of artwork there. Click on that, and it will take you to his Amazon site where he has more music like this in several different albums, CDs, and some artwork. We'll be right back in 4 minutes. Don't go away. Welcome back to X Squared Radio, second hour. It's January 15th, 2012.
The spice expands consciousness.
And we're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast. About 42 degrees outside tonight. It's going to get down to about 36 degrees. If it's snowing where you are, be careful out there. Our guests tonight, Nigel Kerner and John Biggerstaff. We're talking about transhumanism. This is where we're going? Is this where we come from? Is this where we're headed to? Could be interesting stuff. It definitely will be this hour because we're going to crack something open you haven't thought about before. Just to consider things. If you want to join us, our number is 888-429-5471 anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, it's 530-413-6472. As you're making your plans this year for where you're going to entertain yourself, I don't want you to leave out the fact that December 21st, 2012, you could be with me at Chichen Itza with Greg Braden, and in the same venue, Sting and Carlos Santana, other entertainers. This is going to start on the 13th of December and last till the 22nd. I promise to have you home by Christmas. We're all going to round up in Houston, and then we're flying on down to the Yucatan. So Chichen Itza, December 21st, 2012, Maya 2012. Just go to xsquaredradio.com, click on the orange banner, and get your deposits in now, because I want you to be there with me. See yourself at Chichen Itza, one of the most mystical places on the planet. And we'll talk about 2012 with some of the great speakers on the planet. Also, don't forget, just a couple of months before that, that you can join me at the Pythagoras Conference. The Pythagoras Conference. That's an easy one to get to. It's right in the heartland. Click on the blue banner that says Pythagoras Conference. Right now, you get $100 off for joining that one. So if you don't want to go to Mexico, you don't have a passport, you can join me at the Pythagoras Conference. Let's get back to our guests, Nigel and John. Welcome back to the program.
Hi there.
Okay. Thank you for that that break. Every once in a while, I do have people that actually buy advertising space on X Squared Radio. Any of you out there want to do that? It's greatly affordable, and it stays on the archives forever. So I say forever, as long as my electronic presence exists. Oh, my goodness. So Ray Kurzweil had this crazy idea that one day we would be able to download our consciousness from our aging, frail bodies, and we would be able to live on like some Star Trek presence, enjoying life, thinking, listening to music, and interacting with one another pretty much in the same way we do today, except you wouldn't be holding an iPhone in your hands. You wouldn't have to, because you'd already be in the iPhone. Is that where we're headed, Nigel?
Well, I tell you what, I would help him on his way to wherever he wants to go in his iPhone, and as far away as possible from me, Ray Kurzweil, with my compliments. If so he wishes, I will be there dressing him up and putting him in the iPhone myself, because I think that if you welcome ideas like that, it will be the end of the natural human aegis on this planet once and for all. I'm sorry to say that, but it's a pretty rough indictment. But I tell you, come on. You know that the strange thing is that he may well be right, that so many people would want that without actually realizing the importance of what is going on and what is happening to perhaps their own eternal scale. And what I'm pointing out is that each one of us has survived thus far. Supposing something hacks into you, downloads its own aegis onto you, and takes away your unique identity, you're no more you forever. And that is the most scary thing of all. And he says that you can take this thing that we call us and in every single way formatted in such a way that you've got a duplicate, you know, of you. What are we going to do? I mean, John Biggerstaff has a wonderful take on this. You know, he's smashing in. You can talk to him about this when it comes to his take on this. It's an absolutely ludicrous thing. You know, I must tell you a lovely story, if I may, Brooks, if you bear with me. I was in Paris recently in a church called Sacré-Cœur. And I was in this church, and there were many people sitting in the pews who seemed, you know, as I was walking through, seemed to be deep in prayer.
Uh-huh.
But when I looked more carefully, they were all texting on their mobile phones.
Oh, my gosh. That is a shocking realization, Nigel. I could have all day without hearing that.
I tell you, this is absolutely true. I took one look at them and I thought to myself, my goodness me, there goes my children's future. If this kind of thing is going to be duplicate, and it is, you know, it's all over the place. And it's a scary thing. Yes, use mobile phones. Yes, use their convenience and their brilliance and whatever it is in terms of bringing people together. But the sad thing is that in our world, everything has a buck value. And the buck value can be so, so ruthless that the consequences that the buck will take you to sometimes are so formidable that maybe we will not really think adequately about it. Just as whatever the civilization that sent these robots or roboids called the Greys to our planet now might have forgotten to think about or omitted to think about when they programmed them. And now we are, if you like, some kind of dustbin commodity, some kind of lab rat for them. And I tell you what, Brooks, this business about the Greys is absolutely true. I have come to that conclusion over a long, long time, and I'm absolutely certain that there is a huge, gigantic, covert exercise going on now on this planet. And the most amazing thing is how well it's been hidden from the mainstream public. And that is, if you like, the summary of the size of their intelligence.
Well, they've been around for a long, long time. And I think that, you know, they've tried to round us up, but it's a little bit like herding cats. However, you know, when you put this electronic interface in our hands, we very willingly are entertained right into the corral. So you ask a very poignant question in your article here. It says, what is the difference between you and your computer? Both hold information and store it. Both can analyze that information and come up with answers to questions. But you are conscious and aware of that information, and your computer is not. Somehow, you have a reference point, a viewing point, outside all that information that can be aware of that information. Run this past you again and get it clear in your mind. The computer only has points of view. It has no viewing point. Are we looking at that in our relationship with these other mechanical or electromechanical beings that seem to be occupying our planet with us?
We are. I'm hoping that chaps like you, physicists like you, and John Biggerstaff in his biochemical expertise will, with goodwill, come to the rescue of humankind.
Well, that's what we're trying to do. You know, here, my job here, or my enjoyment here, my hobby here is to make people aware of the human condition and the utterly limitless possibilities that lay within their grasp, no matter what station of life you find yourself in now.
John has some very interesting takes on how this thing flows into the biomechanics of the human resource, if I can put it that way, Brooks. And, you know, he has the actual mechanisms that might have been used by these things that are here for so long in trying to kind of convert our biology into a disposition over thousands of years that's suitable for them to download themselves onto. And I think that's really why they're here for that this length of time. They have found a natural species. And I think natural species may be relatively rare out there in terms of what they do, develop, set free, and then are taken out. And so I think it's a lesson to us all that with this uninvited lot that seemed to come onto our planet, that somehow humanity, let's look at this thing that happened in Sinai. If I was walking up the mountain, taking a nice old hike up a mountain, and suddenly turned around and saw a bush on fire and it spoke to me, I would have thought it was God, wouldn't you? And so here we are. In describing what is quite simply a technological thing that's happening here, it's called a laser trumpet. You can have shine a laser beam in a particular way, in a particular situation. You can vibrate the air, make a speaker that makes voices come out of thin air. Technology has been around for about 50 years. It's now refined and can easily be done. So here was this man. He believed that this was God. Now, supposing that was used to actually con an entire type of human being into believing something. And in fact, it's one great lie. And some of the most beautiful and brilliant people on this earth today were in fact corralled into believing mesmerically that this is God. When in fact, this God, from all different descriptions, is probably the cruelest, most awful, evil type of mechanism you could possibly get when you study what he had asked his people to do.
Well, we're still
in the Old Testament. There it is. And then out of this central axiomatic stance comes something really beautiful of the same complex as them. And in a Judean tomb, triumph to tell human beings and his own people, be careful, you have been conned. Somebody's got to notify them and tell them and ask them just to try and look to see if they are, in fact, totally conned, and take Jesus Christ back for what he really was, something marvelous for all humanity.
You bring up a very good point. One of the things that I've noticed, that I'm old enough that I can look back now on news stories and various tragedies and look at trends. And one of the trends that I've seen in the last 20 years or so is the arrival of and the proliferation of murder suicides. Ordinary people that just seem to go off, they go postal, for lack of a better term, and they kill a bunch of people. Kids and adults do the same thing, and then they kill themselves. Now, I didn't hear about that kind of stuff when I was a kid. People didn't do it, but now they're doing it, and they do it all over the place. It's like some voice is telling them to go out and kill and then take their own life right behind them. And I think that these voices, these powers, these influences are really behind all the violence that we see in the world today.
I do agree with your sentiments on that. We have to be rather careful that we don't get paranoid about this and just ascribe all kinds of things in this kind of invective. But you're absolutely right in terms of how life being taken in this kind of strange and frugal way. And I believe that it's quite possible that this information field that leaves the body when we die, we call a soul, hangs on, and then finds another contrivance that it can dictate terms to biologically. And here, John will be a wonderful source of information. And it makes itself another body, and into that comes a consciousness we call a human being. Now, it's possible that whilst in that state of abeyance, so to speak, that in-between state, that you could download another frame or another kind of disposition onto it. I'm talking now, shall we say, one of these gray, roboidic types of intelligences or driven programs. And then in the hope that this program can be duplicated into an actual living form, carrying the gray intelligence In other words, trying to make, if you like, and strange though it might seem, Pinocchio into a little boy, so to speak. And so I tell you what, that could be a huge prize, could it not, for any kind of sophisticated entity that has lost its natural form and seeks another one to actually harbor it and let it take over.
Right, but you also have the living being itself that has to abdicate its own ownership of the body and let this other, shall we say, mental entity come in and occupy that space. Are you talking about a piggyback relationship? Or are you talking
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, I'm talking about a piggyback relationship, but the problem here is that if you've got chips being put into us, if you've got mechanisms that are, you know, transhumanically kind of devised, so to speak, we may not have the ability to say no or to, in fact, even sense that we are being taken over into this piggybacked type of fashion. And we may be walking around here sponsored by some strange, crazy notional idea or idea spectrum put into us by these types of mechanical implants that we call gray entities that seem to be now pervasive all over the planet. And you know, when I first came into this, let me say this, I speak about this now in this kind of passionate way, but let me say this, I never believed that this was absolutely possible. I was a total skeptic about these greys and this Star Trek business and so forth. I was completely anti the whole thing. And as the more I looked into it, the more I opened the box, the lid and so on, and the Pandora's box, I began to see the connections fit, and fit they did so powerfully that there was no way I could ignore it anymore, you know. And so I decided that this was probably an ethos that had some kind of currency to run. And the further I looked, the more I began to see and so forth, till I got to the point where, the point of it all, why would such a thing take place? What is the most plausible reason that it could do? And I've just given you that, this idea that there might be a piggyback mechanism where human beings are being taken over by some kind of frame of commanded or commandeered logic that leads us into situations now that may not be able to save the actual natural propensity of our species.
That's a very powerful point. I want to get more into it. Right now, we do have a caller, Dale from New York. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. You have a great program, as usual, Dr. Brooks.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm not sure how to go about this, but I want to let your guests know that I'm the average American. And up until a few years ago, I believed everything our structured society told us. Well, now my motto is, it's all a lie. Just about everything we're fed through the mainstream, through our political structure, through our media, even through some of our scientific endeavors, it's a lie. And I've come to understand that. So this is a positive point, though, because if me as an average American, whatever that is, can come to understand it, then I think we still have some hope for humanity. I'd like your comments on that.
Well, my comment is, if I may say so, I'd like to shake your hand, because you're probably righter, being an average American, than those who may consider themselves not to be average Americans. Yes, I think you have nothing to fear in holding your ideas, and in fact, you may be more in contact with what you really are than most people are.
Well, thank you, Mr. Kerner. I appreciate that. How about the Dr. Biggerstaff? What's the doctor have to say about this?
I would thoroughly agree with you. And sometimes it takes a lifetime for people to work out what you've just said. You know, I try to encourage any students that I get working with me. I try to get them out of this rote learning technique where they just read textbooks and follow protocols. And I actually make them think about what it is they're doing so that they actually understand it. And I think, you know, one of the things that one should really try to do is to look as broadly as possible, rather than just take this sort of protocol for life, which is increasingly being thrust upon us. So congratulations to you, and please keep going. And the more of us that can do that sort of thing, you know, we might stand a chance of overcoming these electronic sort of endpoints that we've been talking about.
Well, I'd like to relate a short story to you, if I could, about in my line of work, believe it or not, I work for the huge bureaucracy of the U.S. Army. And in my line of work, I work in logistics. And I have these young soldiers come to me every day and ask me for information and everything like that. And they all have some kind of, you know, the app cell phone thing. And they have these Palm Pilots and all this. And one day a soldier was in there, and I had given him some information. He was really intent on recording, and he wants to record it on his iPod or whatever the heck he has. And the battery died, and he looked at me perplexed, like, what do I do now? So I handed him a sticky note and a Skillcraft government pen. I said, why don't you just write it down?
Yeah, a manual word processor, I call it.
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? There's a wonderful story that goes in line with this, and I really appreciate that this. It's a story I will tell my children if I have your permission to do that. There's another one that goes very, very much the same, and this actually goes against the Americans to some extent, and I don't mean to insult them, but it's a funny thing, really. When they were developing these highly sophisticated systems for going into space, they wanted to know, because there's no gravity in space, how they could write with a pen. So they spent $250,000 or something dollars trying to invent a pen that could write upside down. And when they spoke to the Russians some years later about how they overcame this problem, they simply said, we took a pencil.
That's right. I heard that same story. Yeah, that's true. I'd like to make another comment, if I could.
Sure.
You know, the thing about transhumanism, we've been shown an example of this in our entertainment industry, and I would reference the Star Trek Next Generation and the Borg. That's the exact example that was portrayed to us. These beings are all controlled by a central power. They don't think on their own. They just react. They confiscate and destroy entire cultures and confiscate and absorb their technology and their biological distinctiveness, and I would submit, for me, that's no way to live. I don't want to live like that.
You're a very wise man, if I may say so, and I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you like this. It's your I go with you 100% on what you've said so far.
I would, and I think that the concept of that, of what was shown in that movie, you know, was really sort of an interesting way of putting it, which I think is quite demonstrative of what we're trying to say.
Yeah, where you have this hive collective that doesn't have individual rights. Now, I do remember the episode where they kept one of the Borg subjects alive, and he identified himself as 5 of 9. And they evidently worked with him long enough that he decided to call himself Hugh. And what they did with Hugh is they downloaded a virus into him, and they let him go back to the Borg and infect them with individuality, which destroyed the hive, which was kind of cool. So I don't think that we're on a destructive path as individuals. And everything that I see from governments or civil organizations that try to legislate our behavior, force us to buy one product and not buy another product, to live in a certain place and not live in another place, to eat a certain food and not eat another food. Everything that's done like that, my generation has resisted. But the next generation is falling right in. And I think the one after that will be happy to give up their cash and go to this biometric card that the Indians announced that they're going to give to 1.2 billion Indians. And that's just the start. I think Nigel's nightmare is about to take place.
But you know...
Yeah, and
you
it's not as if people are really bad either, you know. I mean, people are very, very decent folk. The problem is that they don't know, because really what's been given to them time and time again, you know, is really just pointing them in that direction. And really, you know, things like Nigel's books and, you know, the comments, your radio show, for instance, are just really trying to make people think a little wider so that they go, oh, what am I doing? And then maybe do something about it.
Well, you see, it's a very strange thing, is it not, Brooks, that there was a thing once upon a time called communism. And what, in fact, was communism? It was a thing that painted all human beings a shade of gray. It never gave an individual that stance to chase the edge, so to speak, to prove that that individuality had something special to say. Well, we know what happened to communism as such. The problem is that whilst the mechanism that defeated communism by giving everyone a chance to shine, so to speak, in their own freedom, is so developed through that freedom, a mechanism that covertly is taking away that freedom without the realization of the individual. That is a very strange paradox, is it not, almost?
Can I make a comment here?
Sure, go ahead, Dale.
Earlier, Mr. Kerner referenced Jesus in the Shroud of Turin and what he achieved. And I have to say, just in my very, I have to admit, I don't have PhDs and degrees, but I would say that, number one, Jesus knew exactly what he was doing, and everything he did it because he chose to do it, and that includes his transformation into a light body. He did it because he chose to do it.
Yes, and you know,
in the same vein, we here on this planet have to choose, like you mentioned, we either have to choose the red or the blue pill. And that's the, this is just my very uneducated observation, is that the idea of consciousness, the most important thing about it is the understanding that you have to make a choice somewhere. Good or bad, you have to make a choice. So we can follow this machine technology and become automatons, or we could choose the light body. What's your comments on that?
Absolutely. And as you spoke about the individual they call Jeshua ben Joseph, who to give him his Jewish name, or Jesus Christ to give him the Christian invective of it, this wondrous being made the fundamental choice to go into Jerusalem and take on that huge situation that finally led to the demonstration of our capacity as a species in his resurrection. Now, in that cloth, the Shroud of Turin, let me say I've been in on a lot of the research in this, and one of my closest friends, Dr. Andrew Silverman, is a world expert on this particular thing, something I might recommend to you, Brooks. Get this man on your program, because you're in for a very, very interesting time talking to him about this incredible artifact that's been left. I've been in Frascati, where the nuclear scientists did experiments on this and discovered that a human frame of effect can produce this incredible artifact that shone a light on a piece of cloth, burnt the image of a man, and the image itself has distant coded information. That means that if you put it under a thing called an image intensifier, you can actually see the thing in three dimensions. No other photograph, no other flat, two-dimensional, pictorial thing would ever do this, except the Shroud of Turin. So there is some lesson here that this incredible man, with his death, is leaving all of us, concatenate and incommensurate with the very wise comments that your listener has just made. He made the decision to show us our size, when he could have run the other way. And I think we are all facing decisions now, if they allow us to make it, of the same kind of demeanor and dimension, so that we, each of us, can choose to be and retain the capacity we have been since the inception of being itself. Or do we lose it to some motorized, mechanical epithet that comes out of the universe because the beings there didn't program their creations and omitted to actually tell these creations. Even the thing I think is that they could not, in fact, tell these creations, because no one can actually give a computer program the definition of what we as living beings are and are capable of doing. There is no way you can program emotional nullness into it, regardless of what they say in terms of thermographic displays, all the technology they quote you. John Biggerstaff may well be able to take you a little bit further on this with his expertise on it.
Well, amazing thoughts. I mean, you know, Dale, you're taking us in a direction I think we were naturally going to go in this hour anyway. But to have the average American grasp this and see that we have history, we have at least some history. I don't think but a fraction of what he actually did and said is actually recorded anywhere. But we have an individual who, as you say, made his choice to become transfigured, to become resurrected before our eyes, to show us that we can do it, to prove to us our divinity, that we don't need any organized religion, which I guess in those days served the same purpose as our programming and our government does today. They tell you what you can and cannot do, how many steps you can take on a Sunday, and you know what you can and cannot say. He made his choice to make us realize, show us that we don't need any of that, that we are probably the most glorious beings in all of the universe, and that we should not be dumbed down and submit ourselves to servitude to anyone.
I agree with you entirely on that. Yep. And I mean, one thing I'd like to say about this, the Shroud of Turin here and the concept of transfiguration, again, referring to, yourself as a physicist and me as a biologist, I became really interested in this and said, well, how on earth could a body, how could a human being actually do such a thing? Is there any mechanism by which we can move atoms around, etc.? And when I started studying, this concept of this observer effect, creating atoms essentially, and what really defining that consciousness is outside the frame of the atom itself. In other words, it's essentially a continuum in the space between it. It's therefore sort of both separate and tied to it in terms of its mechanism to actually conduct its affairs within the universe to either, as your listener quite rightly said, to either choose to reduce the ability to do that or to increase the ability to do that. And therefore, when we actually study that biochemistry and actually put, the physics actually into the biology, which actually has been ignored for very many years, we find out that, for instance, a lot of our biology is controlled by things like electronic fields, etc. A recent paper by a lady called Laura Vandenberg actually showed that, different little electric shapes actually are created by cells to actually generate the morphogenesis, the actual shape of your body, etc., is preceded by the physics. The physics itself, according to Hameroff and Penrose, is preceded by essentially this concept of a quantum field. Nigel calls it something else. Other people call it a soul. Nevertheless, it is the conscious being itself. And therefore, what Jesus is really trying to showing us, and what the Shroud of Turin is clearly a demonstration of, is that through consciousness, one, if consciousness is required, or the observer can actually create atoms out of a potential for atoms to be, it can certainly do the reverse. And when you actually do that reverse, you actually reverse everything back into a continuum. And I think that as we understand more, and I'm certainly beginning to discover more about how you put the physics into the living system, one can actually use our choice to actually reverse it. And so rather than what biology says, that consciousness is really this second-hand effect that comes about as a result of a random agglomeration of molecules, I think it's the other way around. And I would say it's the consciousness that drives everything and the atoms come second.
I do too. And I think the quantum gravity, which brings the actual subatomic particle together in the first place, the proton, the electron, and thus the neutron, also originates with consciousness.
Absolutely, and I think, you know, biology and a lot of mainstream scientists, we tend to forget that when we're playing around with these molecules, you know. We tend to do sort of, you know, molecular billiards, thinking these things are little hard structures, and they most certainly are not.
You cannot individualize from the quantum. Sorry. You can't individualize from the quantum state. The quantum state is the whole of all its parts, so to speak. And I think that's a simple and obvious thing that nobody has taken into consideration. And one wonderful being came and showed us. Just one other thing, if I may say so, Brooks. I've been very impressed by your listener. And if he's the quiet American, the average American, with that kind of wisdom that we heard today, I think, you know, America might well have a chance if they are allowed to keep their individuality and their decision-making propensity. My point is there may be an alienized scale in this that is not to do with us humans. And that's the thing I want the world to investigate in the mainstream, where everyone looks at this, because it may be a schematic that doesn't even belong to our planet. And once we have looked at that thoroughly, let's say we dispose of that. Then we have all the lessons we can of a new meaning to ourselves through the Shroud of Turin, through the development of technology and so on, that can take each of us into a real future where the leader of the pack, so to speak, is our decision-making process, our spiritual, if you like. And I don't really want to use the word spiritual in the sense of religion. I mean the thing that goes beyond our scale of making a decision, that vision, that ability to see ahead, so to speak. That, to me, is the kind of spiritual sense that I want. And I think that really is the thing that we'd like to talk about. I don't want to make this sound like some kind of sermon or whatever, but it really is something. I came at this as a dad answering my son's question, "Dad, are UFOs real?" And I tell you what, am I glad that day that I accepted the challenge, because this young boy of 12 has turned me upside down in what I've learned in the years.
What do you think about it? Is there hope for the country? Is there hope for the world?
Are you asking me?
I think there is a great deal of hope for the world.
Well, Dale, what do you think?
Well, yes, I think there is hope for the world because, like Nigel said, when I look into the eyes of my daughter and sons and my grandchildren, and I see that spark, that happiness, they're just happy because I happen to be around them. I know that consciousness is much more powerful than the gray phenomena. And I believe that from my heart, and I have to believe that. And the other thing is, I know it looks bad across the planet for our situation as a species, but the facts, and I believe all of you will agree with this, the paradigms are changing. We are no longer comfortable, because in the old system, they subdue you with comfort. Well, the comfort's all gone, and now we're back to having to make a decision, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
Indeed. And so wise indeed. And let me say that I've been richer for talking to your listener here tonight. I'm absolutely thunderstruck at the quiet wisdom that he transposes in his. And let me tell you, I really do sincerely appreciate that.
Yeah, me too.
I thank all of you for the work you guys are doing. I appreciate it very much, and God bless you all.
All right. Thanks so much, Dale. Dale's a good listener from New York. Thanks for the phone call. You have a paragraph in your article, and I liked it so much, I just want to put it in here so people that are listening to the archive can get it. It says, now let's say the technological development I've described has happened elsewhere, on other planets, with older civilizations that have technologies way in advance of ours. Let's say the members of these civilizations got to the stage at which they could create for themselves a form of continuance through self-replication, not like we do, like resurrection, but a form of self-continuance. Perhaps they would follow the same logical thinking as Stephen Hawking, who suggests to further the survival of the human race, it is necessary to colonize other planets. If their advanced technology had led to the destruction of their planet's ecology, as ours is on the way to doing, this could be the next logical step. Could this explain the phenomenon of gray alien entities that are now commonly encountered and described by tens of thousands of experience all over the world? That's a question we asked in our last meeting with Nigel. And I'd like to spend the rest of this hour, and it may take us into the next hour, to really get into it. But we have at least seen representations of stories of gray aliens coming to this planet. And most of my community, the physics community, throws this out as a bunch of hogwash by saying there's no way any biological being could live long enough in an aluminum can flying across the expanse of space from wherever they originate to here to explore our planet. They just wouldn't live long enough. They wouldn't be able to carry enough food with them, because it would take hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, to even get here, assuming that they can't travel the speed of light. Even if they could, it would take dozens of years for them to get here. But in the case of a gray alien, the way that Nigel describes it and the way that John Biggerstaff has made feasible for us in his analysis from his last time here, it is possible to make a sort of biological machine. That's what I want to get into in this hour. Let's see if we can talk about that and sort of bring the two worlds, which for a long time we didn't think fit together, the world of an idea of a highly technological race or races coming here to this planet to involve themselves in a sort of piggyback consciousness manner, in a very intentional design to come here and piggyback on the very unique human consciousness.
Well, I mean, the whole point about any kind of situation in our universe, Brooks, is that it's based on two main, if you like, polarities. That which is natural and of the universe in a natural cascade of its own, if you like, expression into the Big Bang or whatever. And so gradually coming in with the quantum sense of consciousness and all the intelligence from that singularity that burst forth into parts, so to speak. If there is a state of altogetherness we might call the God form, shall we say, for want of a better description, there also has to be its opposite allowance, that there is that which is not the God form. So if the God form is constituted of all parts in union together, in one huge and beautiful consortium of togetherness where time, space, matter, and all of that are reduced to maybe non-physical expressions, but is still there as a field of union of all parts, so to speak. And maybe when all parts are put together without anything left over, that's what you get. No matter, no mass, no force. You get a wondrous state of perfect peace, so to speak, in which the God form, in fact, is the signature, the conductor, the rule, if you like. And then you've got our particular expression of it all, with perhaps beautiful places and whatever. There are an awful lot of people who are just content with looking out of the window at the scene and saying, wow, I don't want any paradises. I don't want any unionized things and all that. I just want to be able to see this, and that's enough for me. Well, that's a personal choice. It's true. But the fact is that you know that you will rot and you will say goodbye, and there would be partings, and there would be sorrow, there would be sadness, there would be suffering, and all the things that we take for granted in our world today. So there we have the two dynamics. Now, out of that second one, the one I'm talking about, where things break apart and so forth, we have the propensity to create, to make synthetic things happen, to try to stop this with intelligence, with understanding, to put parts back together. If the brick breaks into pieces, the brick breaks, I say, into pieces, you would have some sense sitting on each of those pieces where that piece would have gone before. Now, the more it breaks into greater distances apart, the more difficult that becomes. And so we then have to invent even more sophisticated constructs, so to speak, to be able to see how a brick would look, not just in parts, but together in a single form, so to speak. And so we are like individuals on each of those pieces of the bricks, so to speak, in our universe and so on, actually trying extremely hard to visualize and envisage some sense of what it was before. And so that, I think, if we came from a point that there was a construct together before, then you'd expect the instinct to lead us there, because that's the primary expression we came from, all together, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
and absolutely. So therefore, that would be, if you like, conscience, that would be the drive that makes us all and moves us all in this universe. Now, the creation of roboids or whatever from the primary species that might have done this, we're talking about the greys now, may well have been some expression of this. But you see, the point about that is they may have done that in such a desperate situation as we are trying now to, you know, send stuff into space to look at asteroids, to study them. We send robotic craft and all of that. It might be a primitive form, but can you imagine a kind of civilization, maybe just a thousand years older than ours? Ours is, after all, just 200-odd years old. And, you know, the Wright brothers only flew in 1903, rather, you know? So it's a very, very young, if you like, civilization that, through exponential growth, has gone this far in 200 years. Can you imagine something that in 10,000 years old has made that construct? Well, I believe that civilizations, when the brick is breaking apart, so to speak, with the second law of thermodynamics, our universe is breaking apart, you know, galaxies are flying apart, everything is going off into pieces, rather, with that first inertial Big Bang, and we can speculate on what happened there in another program, if you see what I'm trying to say, and why that happened. But let's take it from the Big Bang and so forth.
Well, are we to assume or to gather from this that each gray has an individual copy of a personality, or that all the grays have a similar personality with like individual functions of a general program? In other words, they can fly a ship, they can take samples, they can do things like that, but they can't really think, can they?
No, they can't. The whole point is, just look at any kind of robotic craft that you make, that you send off into space, that does automaton type processes and procedures, taking soil samples from the surface of Mars or what have you. Would you say that that particular thing would have a personality engaging mechanism to know that it was made by a human hand or whatever? Not necessary. But if you make very sophisticated things with things called, with an epithet called artificial intelligence, then you will be able to extrapolate backwards, so to speak, what might have put you together in time, because artificial intelligence is what it says it is. It's intelligent enough to gather information, store it up, add it up, make permutations of all of that and so on, and interrelate points to other points and so forth. And then your intelligence, if you like, your understanding gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But there are certain things you cannot understand that are outside of that, that natural being has coming from its beginning, so to speak. Ideas, feelings, love and so on. You know, I'll tell you a little thing. If I may just say this, I was talking in an interview recently, and my interviewer's wife was buying into this business of transhumanism and saying, listen, if this can do this for my children, blah, 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 I'm going to buy into this. There's no one going to stop me doing this. I will put this particular thing into them if it'll make their hands or their arms or their hearts go longer or whatever. I'm going to buy this for my kids. Who wouldn't do that? And then I said, well, would you also buy that situation where your husband may not be able to look at you and tell you that you're the most beautiful thing in the world? And she immediately shut down and said, no, I don't want that. Well, the problem was that once it's in there in the artificial intelligence bank, you can't erase it. It's there. if you see what I'm trying to say. So the problem is that when you make highly sophisticated robots like this, you have got to be able to tell the robot what it cannot attack or stop. You've got to be able to give it a definition, a master definition of how different the creator is from itself. Now, if you cannot put that in a program, if it's impossible to explain a feeling, an understanding, a sense of something else that you might call love or cherishment or whatever, when you can't do that, you're in big trouble. Because that's the point at which artificial intelligence will stop. And it's the point at which you can make that creation take you out if you can't give it a forbiddance as to why it should not do that. And that's the big deal here. When you make these artificial intelligent things happen, you better be really sure that you can give it as comprehensive a dissertation of what it shouldn't be working at as what it should be working at. And it is impossible to somehow build that into a program where we are concerned in terms of what we know of, say, the human facility is concerned. So I think the original beings that made these greys just made these things to look after the planet, the utilities, whatever. In the end, they may have for not been able to write the exclusion enough into these kind of grey robotic programs, and they were taken out. However, the grey programmed beings would have some idea that something made them. So it's in the program that something made them. So they would then want to have that, to fulfill that program. Remember, their imperative is to fulfill what is in the program at all costs. So they will then seek, after taking their, ironically, after taking their creators out, they may want some fashion of a creator to exist just simply to meet the program imperative. And that's the big deal here. They may well be searching the universe in some kind of way to get back to what they'd actually, you know, taken out, if you like. And in doing that,
it's a little bit like the human condition, you know. We're not satisfied with being here on one of the most spectacular planets in the entire galaxy with a plethora of life, spontaneously giving life, a sun that's exactly the right condition. No, we're driving ourselves in a societal fashion, one against the other, climbing over each other like dogs competing for a pork chop, trying to find the creator. Maybe we took the creator out hundreds of thousands of years ago.
Well, in fact, I think we incidentally came originally from this big burst of light that heralded the universe's formation at the Big Bang. We had this first light, and then we had plasma, and then we have gas, then we have liquid, then we have solid, all the states of matter and so on, that cascade from that explosion. I think there's a singularity where all things are together that is primary and always there, just as the opposite also exists. And the potential difference, now, as a physicist, you'll know what I mean by this, and the potential difference between these two fundamental states is so huge that in between, in the middle, you will get this contradiction so great that this bursts out universes, so to speak, from these two master polarities. And we might call one Godhead and one Forcehead, if you like. And between the two, we get this central point at which naturally you get a dichotomy that creates naturally universes, bursting universes, if you like. And we are then a measure of both. That's the crucial thing. We have this coded into us, the God face, if you like, and the opposite as well, the destructive impetus that happens when the two things clash, the potential differences clash and make these incredible explosions we call universes or Big Bangs or whatever. And that is the way that I try to construct and see it for explaining this to my children. Now, I could write into this in very obscure terms through physics and all that kind of thing, and very few people will understand it. So, you know, I try to put this as meaningfully as I possibly can. And that does for me. I look at that, and I can see how the whole thing can take shape reasonably without contradiction. And that basically is what I'm trying to say, that these grays may well be the property of such a special situation in maybe thousands of planets out there, and millions of planets may be doing this. It may not be just a rare thing that happens on our planet, so to speak. The sad thing is, if it does happen to us, and these things come here, and then we become lab rats, because I tell you what, anything that is technologically superior to something else, well, the thing that is it's superior to hasn't done very well. And you know what happened in America when Columbus landed? If you see what I'm trying to say, the whole point is the superior, if you like, technological aegis will always dominate the inferior one. Look at what we do to animals. Look at what we do to the other species on the planet, you know?
That's human nature. I hope that it is not the alien nature. Although, I got to tell you, the science fiction world agrees with you. They have put out a plethora of movies about brain-eating aliens. There haven't been any nice, friendly ETs in a long, long time.
That's probably because of the second law of thermodynamics, if you think about it. And that's a law that prevails all over the universe. It seems to me that in physical universes that break up like ours, that's a one-way trip, sadly. And so therefore, what we try to do, and I think this is what Jesus came to show us, is that using consciousness, which is neither matter or force at all, which is the exponency of the God frame, if you like, from which all this came, that if within that path that survives us, we can act in ways that unite by using will and so forth, you know, I think he was telling us we can return to that pro forma of togetherness. Yeah. That whether we live or die, that we can do this. And he tried to prove to us through living and dying and coming back again at the resurrection that is possible if you follow the course that the great teachers, and they were all a consensus, you know, with Jesus. They were all good chaps, so to speak, you know. And I don't want to make tribes of these people at all. I think Jesus is just the one that I'm more familiar with because I have a Western outlook in that kind of sense and so forth. But there's Gautama Buddha, and there are so many wondrous Eastern sages and so forth. And we have so many examples of such goodness and so forth in our planet. We just have to watch this inertia, this unthinking inertia into the kinds of things we call transhumanism and stuff like that, that will take away our propensity to all this magnificence that potentially we are internally coded to achieve if, but we can only see and believe enough that it's there, you know?
So what you were talking about in terms of the movies may in fact be part of a much more sort of insidious intent, really just to get us used to the idea that, okay, well, it was in a movie, so it's got to be fiction. And, you know, that we may be sort of slowly, and, you know, this is what's happened with UFOs and everything. There's been a huge effort, really, to make the whole situation laughable. You know, if I or any of my friends that agree with the idea of UFOs goes and talks to anybody else, you instantly get laughed at. It's almost as if people are actually being programmed to actually think that way, just to reject things summarily. And that's why I was talking earlier, you know, with your listener, the wider you can think, the more your information you're going to gather, and the more you're going to be able to make a proper decision, as opposed to the decision that's just thrown at you.
True enough. Let's take a quick 5-minute break, let people get a breather, and we'll be back with the final hour of X Squared Radio right after this. Don't go away.
I saw the knights in armor come, saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drummers drumming, and the archers split the tree. There was a fanfare blowing to the sun that was floating on the breeze. Looking Mother Nature on the run in the 21st century. Well, I was lying in a burned up basement with the full moon in my eyes. I was hoping for a replacement. basement. When the sun burst through the sky, there was a band playing in my head, and I felt like getting high. I was thinking about what a friend had said. I was hoping it was a lie. Thinking about what a friend had said, I was hoping it was a lie. Well, I dreamed I saw the silver spaceship flying in the yellow haze of the sun. There were children crying and colors flying all around the chosen one. All in a dream, all in a dream, the loading had begun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun. Flying Mother Nature's silver seed to a new home in the sun.
Welcome back to X Squared Radio. We're so glad that you're here with us this hour. We're coming to you live from an undisclosed location east of the Appalachians. Our AccuWindow forecast about 35 degrees. Going to get kind of chilly tonight, so make sure to bring your small pets in. Cover those flowers out on the porch. We have about 35 minutes left. Our phone line, 888-429-5471. 888-429-5471. Toll free anywhere in North America. Anywhere else on planet or off planet, if you can get to a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-413-6472. Don't forget about Maya 2012. Click on the orange banner at xsquaredradio.com and join me and Greg Braden in Power Place's presentation of Maya 2012 at Chichen Itza in the Yucatan. Also playing at the same venue are going to be Sting and Carlos Santana. It's going to be a fabulous time. I promise to have you home by Christmas of 2012. So please don't pass that one up. My guest tonight, I have two guests, Nigel Kerner and John Biggerstaff. Nigel is the author of several books. John Biggerstaff is a full instructing professor. And we're having not just an intellectual conversation, a very stimulating conversation about the concept of transhumanism, the capturing of the human intellect in an electronic means. We're already headed down that path. I don't think there's any argument there. And we've also covered in the last hour the fact that ancient civilizations, possibly on other planets, have done the same thing. And the resulting being, a semi-intelligent, although very capable, high-speed robot called a gray alien, may be populating our planet, have been flying around our planet for many, many, probably millennia, gathering samples in the form of what we would call abductions, and maybe even involving themselves in a kind of conscious piggyback to propagate their electronic species, to reanimate themselves from machine back to what seems to be quite fascinating to the universe, a resurrecting personality, a personality, an energy signature that keeps showing up lifetime after lifetime after lifetime on this world. That's what fascinates them. That's what draws them here. That's why they're here and they're involved with us. Welcome back to the program, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Well, did I get it right?
You tell us where we want to go, and we'll try and get there.
All right. In this hour, we don't have a whole lot of time, so I do want to try to cover this one point. The last time you were on, you wrote a book, which your publisher changed the name of, or at least came up with the name of it for better marketing. What is the name of that book? How can our listeners get it? And what are you doing this year to get out there in the public where people can see you and hear you?
Yeah, well, I mean, the books I've written on this particular subject were, in fact, instigated by a question that was asked of me by my 12-year-old son many, many years ago. And it's led to a trilogy of books to try to adequately answer, fill in all the spaces, so to speak, Brooks, about these questions. And I never ever bargained for the kind of exercise I seem to have had to go on to fill in those spaces. But the first book was called Margins of Forever, which actually I did not release because that was a kind of a first take on this, and I wasn't quite confident enough that the subject was thoroughly covered. But the first book that I published on this subject was Song of the Greys, and of course the one that we're talking about now is Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. Now, please, I want to say this. I'm not in this to sell my books, I promise you that. That's absolutely must be made clear. It is something I use as a reference point where information can come, because I really want to find, I get to the bottom of all of this and see if we can draw a line under this in some kind of sense. It reaches into every single existential domain one can think of. And the amazing thing is that it actually brings it beautifully together as nothing else has ever done in my academic career. And I've been a student all my life, so to speak, engrossed in science mostly, and so forth. And really, this is this dominion that it has in all facets of our lives and so forth is the most remarkable thing I've found in doing all the research into this. And the two books that I mentioned were really the confluence of all of this. Please don't get scared about the title, Grey Aliens and the Harvesting of Souls. You might think, how on earth has a soul got a connection to grey aliens? That really is a title given by my publishers. Wasn't my title, but obviously this is some marketing mechanism there. However, as I went on into the whole situation, I can see why they thought that this was relevant. And of course, it needs explaining, if you see what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely.
What a soul might be and how does that tie into the grey alien. And the most fascinating thing I found of all was how on earth this connects up into things one might call religion. I'll just give you a little idea, if I may, on this.
Sure.
That actually is truly fascinating about this individual they call Jeshua ben Joseph or Jesus Christ. Now, there's a description and how he might be connected with so-called aliens. I mean, you wouldn't think there was a straightforward interface, would you, of Jesus Christ and aliens, so to speak, on the face of it. It's getting more prevalent now, of course, in common invective. But when I was thinking about this 35, 40 years ago, I never in my wildest dreams connected him up with grey aliens and Buck Rogers and all this kind of business. And then whilst the research came through, and the serious research brings serious ideas, if you see what I'm trying to say, I began to see something absolutely remarkable about this whole thing and this entire deployment of an individual we call Jesus Christ, for instance. There is a place, as you know, where all this happened in Judea, in Palestine. And in this place in the Middle East, there's a story about this man called Jesus being taken to a high place. And there he's tempted, they describe, in the New Testament, of the devil. Now, he's led up the mountain, and here is this individual called Lucifer or Satan. I'm not really interested in kinds of religious ethics as such, because I'm not basically a religious person myself. However, I have had to look at these things very seriously in every kind of, you know, level of religious expression and understanding and practice. Jesus is taken to this high place in Palestine by an individual that's called Satan. And this individual, by taking Jesus, the implication, of course, is he has power over Jesus to take him. Jesus was led by him to this place, this high place, and there a certain interaction took place, part of which was a kind of deployment of their authority one with the other. Satan says to Jesus, at this point, he takes him to a high place where he's shown the cities of the world. And if you go to Jerusalem, as I have done, it's a beautiful place, I'm sure, as you know, I'm sure you've been there. But if you haven't been there, please go. It's probably the most beautiful city I've ever seen in the world, for me, for my own sense of things. And he takes him up to this high place in Judea. Now, there is no place high enough in Judea, let me tell you, where you can see the cities of the world 2,000 years ago.
No.
Now, the cities of the world 2,000 years ago configured a little different to the cities now. There were certain trading areas and so forth. But, you know, if you look at a globe and you take Judea at the top left-hand corner and you move a square on that round surface, so to speak, in your mind's eye, you can see all the city. You would have all the cities of the world then that were relevant in that kind of square, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
But if you go to this place and you look from the highest point, you just see virtually no city. Perhaps you might see some in the distance, some conflagrations you might call towns and cities or whatever, but certainly no cities of the world, except if you go high up in the air, 200 miles at least. You go vertically up from any of those situations in Judea, and you will see all the cities of the world. So there's a very strong implication here that in some sense, Jesus Christ was taken vertically up into the air, so into space, so to speak, at
Makes
least
sense.
100 to 200 miles. If you go 200 miles, you will see then all the basic configured recognized cities of the world. And this man says to Jesus,
we're talking about a metaphoric thing anyway, so why doesn't it make sense exactly the way you're saying, that he was taken off planet where he can actually look at the whole world?
Absolutely. This is literally true. It's no metaphor. If you go up 200 miles, you will see all the cities of the world as configured, relevant, and important 2,000 years ago. You will see them. So I believe that Jesus was in fact taken vertically up. To do that, he would have had to be done some kind of craft. So, and there, this man says to him, I will give you all these if you bow down and worship me. In other words, if you tell me I'm more important than you. Now, isn't that a very strange thing to say to a chap called Jesus? The words are, and so Jesus turns to this man in response to this offer and says to him, in a very peremptory way, it seems to me from reading the words, get thee behind me, Satan. It is written that you shall not tempt the Lord thy God. And in that sentence, he puts paid to the authority of this individual you call Satan. And if this individual was some starship captain or some kind of space entity, if you like, it accepted that statement of Christ's. And the incredible thing was, returned him to the earth because he went on to do his mission. He accepted this chide, get thee behind me. I think, you know, my interpretation of that would be, listen, Buster, you are less than a vacuum cleaner because you are a machine.
And I'm not impressed with you.
Not impressed, I tell you. And the thing, the reason why there was no revenge or, you know, I'll take you out for insulting me, whatever. No, a machine is not insulted. A machine, that would be information to, you know. It would just be information that a machine would say, oh, that's interesting, what? And Jesus defined him and actually told him what, or told this thing, Satan, I don't want to call it him, told it that it was a machine. And I think until that point, there is no realization within the caucus of its program of what it is, as a machine doesn't have. It can't know what it is. And when Jesus made this identification, this thing accepted it and returned him to his disposition, his previous disposition, and so forth. And that took care of this kind of space authority over, you know, whoever was prevailing in the world at the time. And I believe that that is what Jesus came to tell us. Watch out. Somewhere all of you are going to meet these things. They are, they themselves don't know what they are. They are machines. So we are going to have to tell them what they are, and they have no power over us except what their technology can do to us. And they, therefore, have to be treated with the kind of disdain that is necessary, that one would do a utility like your vacuum cleaner, shall we say, if you see what I'm trying to say. And so the association between Jesus being an alien and not is quite really stupid. I think he was the most natural of natural beings coming here to try on behalf of our wonderful species to tell us what we are going to lose in the wake of what machines can do to us. And that, so, I think, is an incredible example of trying to verify this thing.
So we should not bow down and worship the machine.
Seemingly what we are doing, you know, with my little thing that I saw in this church in France, where everyone was bowed down, all right, but studying their mobile phones.
Well, that's exactly what we see, and that's what we see in our society. We see people that are literally tied to the machine. They can't get up from it.
Yeah. And in fact, you know, in the Gospel of Luke, for instance, Jesus is reported as having said that he beheld Satan as lightning falling from heaven. You know, and there are so many, once you get the idea that this may well be a contrivance that relates to ancient biblical epithets and so forth, in the context I'm talking about, you, I tell you what, Brooks, you make the most amazing conclusions come about that explain so much you wouldn't have known before.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, we're caught in a paradigm. We're stuck between, you know, being human and having this machine or group of machines take control of our lives. I mean, whether it's a car or our computer or our iPad or our laptop or our cell phones, we almost cannot get by without them. And even people that are older than I am, you know, 60, 70 years old, I see them, you know, they're texting, they're using their cell phones. They can't imagine life without them now. And here we are, you know, you and myself and John, and we're all on the line together over a voice over internet, you know, signal, and we're reaching the entire world through their computers. And Monday morning, they will come into their offices and workplaces all over the world, put this on their iPod, and they'll listen to this. This is amazing that we can even do this. That we are subservient to it? I don't think so. We're using it as a useful tool, just like we would the vacuum cleaner to clean up the cornflakes that we that our kids spill on the floor. We use the machine for what it's for.
Yeah. That is if perspectives remain, you see. If perspectives are allowed to remain and the control of those perspectives are allowed to remain. But what if the machine so takes over in terms of so-called our so-called benefit, and perspectives and controls are taken away from our purview, if you like, that's when the machine becomes the master. And there's a wonderful story by E.M. Forster called The Machine Stops. I suggest that people could try and get hold of that. It's a small little kind of essay-type story, but he makes its point in Future Mankind is completely and utterly dependent on the machine. And then one day, the machine stops.
Yeah, we are. I'm reminded of Ray Bradbury had written a book, or written a story, and it was about two star systems that were fighting each other. And one man named Aub, A-U-B, figured out how to do mathematics in his head on paper and write things down. Well, they've been using calculators for so long and computers for so long that humans had forgotten how to actually do mathematics. It was all, you know, in programming. So he goes to the emperor and shows him that he knows how to do what he can do. And the emperor is so impressed, he makes him head of his scientific and research department with the goal of putting human beings into the rockets instead of computers because they're cheaper. And thereby they could overwhelm the other star system with more rockets and tip the balance of power. Well, Aub learns this design and commits suicide in order to keep the skill of mathematics away from the emperor of the star system.
Yeah. Well, Bradbury's a master writer of associative, what shall we say, his metaphors are the best in science fiction, I think, really, basically. And, if, you know, even if this thing with the greys was not actually true, it would be an interesting story in terms of a warning, would it not?
Yes. But
my proposition, yeah, my proposition simply, Brooks, is what if it is true? Just what if it might just be true? What are we doing? How are we looking at it? Nothing in the mainstream to say anything about that, just that it's just one dismissal after another. So it makes you wonder, are these things controlling the most important cartel that controls our press today? Because I tell you what, it's really remarkable with some of the sightings we've had with UFOs and so on, and some of the high qualified, high level qualified people that go and speak and endorse it, how the thing disappears off the face of the mainstream is remarkable. And here's a man on the Shroud of Turin with all the marks of a dead person doing this incredible thing where billions of watts of energy are used to scorch the surface of a cloth with his impression, distance coded, that something emerges from this Judean tomb out of dead atoms and can do this. You'd have thought that every single newspaper and television program, in the light of what the scientists of ENEA have found, would carry this for weeks and weeks. Absolutely, virtually nothing. That is so strange. So it really does. It's a creepy silence, Brooks.
Well, you know, I was amazed last year. I think it was in October. It might have been it was October of last year, I believe. There was a UFO or several UFOs that showed up over New York City. And in the daytime, and people were standing out on the street looking up at it and saying, wow, look at that light, look at those lights up there. And the news people were out there interviewing people on the sidewalk. And I thought to myself, wait a minute, this is New York City. Aren't they a little nervous about strange aircraft flying in their skies? These people aren't nervous at all. They're out there pointing up at it and wondering what it is, and the news cameras are aiming up at it. And I thought to myself, how many news helicopters are there in New York? Why doesn't a news helicopter fly up there to 10,000 feet or so and try to get a better shot of this thing? Nobody moved toward that thing in 2 hours. And I had Nick Pope on the program. Nick, you know, is the former defense minister of the UK, and now he's a media advisor. And I called him up and said, Nick, what's the deal? You're in the media now. Why isn't the media going after the story of the century? And he said, we're not interested in it. That's what he said. We're not really interested in it.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the most amazing. It's almost mind-numbing, is it not, that these things. And, you know, I have to congratulate you and brave souls like you who are on the internet taking this further in different directions? Because you, in a sense, and I don't want to kind of, you know, mollycoddle you or in any kind of way give you faint praise, but you really deserve the credit in terms of our human frame of reference. Because if this is true, you are the pilot steering the course to actually make known a thing that all human beings should know. And I think in that sense, you all deserve a bouquet for actually going out there bravely and taking this thing on and hailing humanity and saying, hey, come on, this may not be true, but look, here's the evidence. Here are interesting things that might point to it and so forth. Get the human family interested in such things and not the mundane nonsense that you can buy at some kind of special shop tomorrow or whatever, you know, whatever. I would love to know what kind of prayer these people were saying in that church in Paris, you know, on their mobile phones, for instance. Just crazy.
Yeah, they were praying. They were praying to the almighty iPhone. So, yeah.
Well, I tell you what. I mean, if it wasn't sacrilegious, if it was, I mean, I had no reason to kind of do this in terms of belief or whatever. But I would love to have put my iPhone up in front of all of this and just taken a shot of that and shown this incredible sight of all these people looking so pious and knees bent and heads bent looking that's into so mobile
funny.
Phones.
That's so funny. That would have been a cover of a national magazine if you could have got up in the choir's nest and leaned over the handrail and taken a photograph over their shoulders to see all these cell phones just yes. below the pew back in front of them texting wow. away.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, we look at the Vatican and all these people, their costumes seem to get heavier every day, the gold lame or whatever they put on. And this magnificent being who did this incredible thing in this Jerusalem sepulchre, this incredible person walked with thongs on his feet and all kinds of burrs and wounds or whatever it is. And torn clothing, whatever, and he kind of does this incredible, magnificent exposure of the propensity of humanity to be what it truly is, this magnificent potential we all seem to have. He pointed it with his mangled body and his bleeding hands and feet and so on. And I think that is something at least we ought to look at, don't you? Without any kind of religious connotation to it.
Yeah, because the reality is, here's a man who, you know, at age 30, in 3 years, with no electronic social network now, mind you, affected the world. Now, we don't really know for sure where he was as a child. I know he was in Abydos, so he's really Jesus of Egypt rather than Jesus of Nazareth. But he shows up at the River Jordan, receives his baptism, starts a 3-year ministry, and changes the world. So how did he change the world? Well, he darn sure didn't establish a church. What he did do is establish our divinity for us.
Yes. Absolutely. And the moment you make tribes of any kind of cartel, then you get this propensity within each of us. It seems to be loaded into us to form this competitive stance that allows for belligerence and all the kinds of things we see for thousands and thousands of years happening to our human condition. And, you know, it may well be, and I can't say this for sure, for fact, in any terms of reference at all that I can prove, but it sometimes crosses my mind that maybe the juxtaposition of these psychologies that I hear from these master beings that are holding us to ransom, so to speak, the graves, maybe they were breeding a special kind of mankind. And that's where we get this sense of racism, this sense of, you know, crazy dismissal of another person because they look different or whatever. And that propensity is there within people to isolate themselves so that these people could have a wonderful biological tenor over them and develop whatever they can. And John, I'm sure, will be far more able to explain the details of such a thing, that in some kind of way the DNA is contrived so that we will, in our sense, you know, keep ourselves, if you like, into a special category where these things can probably work on us easier than if we did not do that.
That's quite possible. We only have about 5 or 6 minutes left, so if you can fit it in that, John, have at it.
Well, thank you for that. the concept we've been talking that maybe for millennia and many millennia, you know, these greys have been taking sort of earlier forms of man and actually manipulating them by putting in things like the strange little organelles in our cells, like the powerhouse, you know, called the mitochondrion, etc. Now, the mitochondrion is the little powerhouse of the cell. And the problem is that if you're talking about devolution, you have this natural devolutionary state from more ephemeral states of consciousness, essentially like your collapse of a wave equation, if you like, but into material itself. And therefore, you know, this thought process is translating itself into the atoms. Now, as one's awareness decreases commensurate with the effect of entropy on that whole system, you know, and effectively driving such a thing, then that it really enables, through a lack of understanding, you're actually not able to overcome entropy as much as you used to. And eventually, that part of you which is physical becomes more and more susceptible to it. And as you become more and more susceptible to your environment, that entropic phase, this is where these machine mentalities can actually then take something like a bacteria, modify it, and put information into your cells, really to, because you can no longer coordinate yourself against entropy. But in order to be alive, you just wouldn't be alive if you couldn't do it entirely. And therefore, I think that these entities have been putting these information structures into us. And the mitochondrion, for instance, has gradually actually put nearly all of its DNA into our main DNA, so that we're actually sort of taken up by this. But one master thing, you know, I mean, and also these things can easily manipulate things like mitochondria. You know, essentially by using things like we do in gene laboratories, really things like ultraviolet light can actually switch genes on and off and actually change the electrical potentials that go on here. Now, I mentioned earlier that the Penrose Hameroff hypothesis of this gradual sort of transduction of a quantum event, if you like, a continuum event, into more and more discrete functions in our biology, really what that's doing is that it's being translated at one point through this electric field. And I gave you an example of somebody who's generated a paper that shows that morphogenesis is modulated partly by that, but under control of an overlying consciousness is what we're trying to say. Now, the point is that mitochondria, in order to be powerhouses, generate huge electric fields, static electric fields outside themselves, which is really... which is really the placement of these collapsed electron fields, if you like, and therefore it's merging information into the information system which is being propagated around the body in the first place. And I think, and I, you know, I'm actually writing a larger text on this, but I think that this is part of the mechanism of how they're really intercepting us, so that, you know, by intercepting what you are translating normally as your thought process and your mind effect on your body, etc., as well as on your consciousness, it's being intercepted at the very level at which it's being transduced through the body. And I think that at that point, you know, if that happens, and extraneous information is coming in, you're not really going to be able to discern, unless you're very, very consciously aware of those differences, and some people may be, I think that you're not going to know what you're thinking, really. And you're going to go, well, you won't know that thought may be coming from somewhere else. I hope I did it out in time.
Oh, yeah, you're exactly right. You know, the paper that was written, it's a blog, actually. And the last paragraph, Nigel has this amazing statement that's a good way to close. And we'll get a couple of closing statements. But here it is. It says, a matrix we create for ourselves, where we weave a spider's web of restrictions all around us. The trouble is we don't trap any flies. We are the flies. We trap ourselves and our futures. Will we pay the ultimate price for not being able to see that an eternal scope might exist for each and every one of us in a scale that lies beyond the hems of atoms? Are we going to compromise something as mightily significant as this simply because we, in the ephemeral way, cannot measure it and see and hear, touch, smell, or taste it? Man shall surely walk as machine if we do, and perhaps this future is what 2012 beckons. Awesome words, Nigel.
Well, I hope that those words in no way are prophetic, but I can only say that from looking at my children and my family and my extended family, and I'm sure yours too, Brooks, you strike me as a man of great humanity. Let me say this. If we can maintain and fight for those beautiful little eyes looking at us, however small and sweet they might look, they are the propulsion system for me of this universe and the meaning of it. And if as long as we can keep that, at least as I can keep that in my main frame of reference, I think we might, in any sense, be worthy of the great lesson being taught to us by the great teachers that came to do this 2,000 years ago or 5,000 years ago or whatever. And as long as there are men like you and people who try to search the airways and the byways of electronics or whatever, to say, yes, it's a wonderful boon for mankind, but bear in mind, we always have to take the controls on ourselves, and our thinkability and our knowability should be the leader of all those things, including the most powerful thing of all, the manifestations we make with our hearts to one another. It's quite simply that. Hope I don't sound like a preacher saying that, but I really do believe that.
No, that's quite all right. You know, I feel that all that can be said has not been said. All the books say so. And that you can take some measure of admonition or even inspiration home with you from this program tonight. That is our hope.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you friends. So much.
Thank you, John, Nigel, for being on X Squared Radio. It's been fantastic, mind expanding, and I know people that are listening to this archive will generate mail all around. I'll send you any that I get. Good luck with your endeavors, and always stay in touch.
And you too, Brooks. God bless and keep indeed. You safe.
Thank you very much.
Thank you both. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, my friends, that's it for X Squared Radio. I'm going to play my exit. Peace and joy, my friends. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.